If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Bottoming, the LGBTQ mental health podcast about rock bottoming and beyond.
Be sure to follow us on Instagram and Twitter at bottomingpod or visit bottomingpodcast.com for more content relating to each episode.
We've also added a support page to the website to direct you to the right place if you're struggling or need someone to talk to.
Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe and review us on Apple Podcasts.
Hello, I'm Matthew.
And I'm Brendan, and our pronouns are he and him.
Hey, love, it's been a while, hasn't it?
It has been a while. We did our last ep, when was it? Early August.
Mm-hmm.
But we're back for a big, fat, double blockbuster. What's it called? A double, I don't know.
Double bill?
Double bill, yeah. I remember. Oh, I loved the double bills. Hollyoaks double bills were chaotic, but I loved it. That's what we're giving you today anyway, chaos.
It will be chaos by the end of this, chaotic.
Mm-hmm.
You won't know what's it, yeah. With that being said, we are going to save our usual intro for the next episode. So get settled, listen to this one. It's a very, very good one. And then after that, straight on to number two to get your full dose of chaos.
Yeah, because this is not an announcement, but there's more of a... what are we going to say? A statement, of a verbal audio statement.
Just an update.
An update, there we go. Yeah, we have an update about the podcast, the future, what lies ahead, what lies beneath, all sorts. So, but we're not giving anything away, you little rascals. You have to come to the next episode, okay. So, this episode... We interviewed Marianne back in May, so first and foremost, we're so sorry, Marianne, it's taken this long to get this episode out. Initially, we said, oh, next week.
A week or two, it'll be out.
At max. Here we are in September. The main thing is, though, it is an incredible interview, and it was you, I think, that found Marianne, wasn't it, initially?
Yeah, I think I followed Marianne on Twitter for a little while, and some of the work... she's done, I've seen in a few different places. So, yeah, I thought. And then also a person I spoke to through work had recommended that we speak to her as well when we were discussing the podcast. So, yeah, lots of gold star reviews for Marianne.
Gorgeous. Yeah, because we've had a couple of... we've spoken to a couple of guests about trans experiences in the past, but we've never actually gone into trans healthcare and that system and how it can be sometimes harmful to people waiting. Some people have really good experiences. But I think what was really good about the interview is that Marianne herself has been through the NHS system, but she's now working at... it is private healthcare now, isn't it? So she kind of has seen both sides of it. So it's really useful to get that perspective.
Yeah, I think one of the things we always want to do, and we have done in other episodes, is like the personal experience is super important to us, but we also want to make sure that the practical, like, experience side of it is also covered as well. And I think that's why we've maybe not touched on it before, because we wanted to get the right person for it, which, yeah, is why we ended up speaking to Marianne about it. I know, again, I don't need to repeat any of it, but the media in the UK especially, but the US and lots of other countries as well, but they're the hotspots, are a volatile place for trans people. Healthcare, especially in the UK, for trans people is so poor. Wait times can be many, many years just to get a first appointment. I know just over the course of the first few lockdowns, all gender-affirming surgery for trans men was essentially cancelled and put on hold. There was, no bottom surgeries taking place. And that just, like, went. That was fine, apparently, for everyone, because there was barely an article to be seen about it. So it just kind of, again, it just amplifies what trans people are dealing with in the UK and why it needs to be tackled, and also why, you know, Gender GP is one of the organisations Marianne's worked for, why those sorts of organisations have set up in order to provide a service that's just not being offered, which is putting lives at risk. So,
yeah,
but as Brendan said, it was fantastic to chat to her. She's got an absolute treasure chest of facts and information and experiences. So, yeah, thank you again for chatting to us.
And also, I want to highlight, there was a story that came out in July about the NHS deciding to close Tavistock, which was the sole provider of gender identity health services for children and young people in England. And it was because of an independent review of the service. And it basically just found that it wasn't suitable for the amount of, for the growing demand of trans people. But what's positive about it is they're going to replace it with two other centres, one in London and one in the northwest. And we'll add this link to the notes and on the website, but the Mermaids have put together like a pros and cons list of this decision. Some of the points are that there'll be more capacity for gender healthcare services. The regional services throughout England will bring support closer to home, so not everyone's travelling to London. There'll be more a holistic approach to care, connecting different local services, and more support for those on the waiting list to provide a diverse range of pathways for the specialist needs of each individual person. So it seems like a positive move. Obviously, the media and some hateful trolls out there treated this as a really positive decision, and they hailed it as
a
win for the anti-trans movement, but actually it's incredibly progressive, I guess. Well, not incredibly progressive, but progressive for the stage we're at, I think. So that's fantastic. And this news came out after the interview that we had with Marianne, otherwise we would have discussed it.
I think as always with this sort of stuff, like, we would always advise following, checking out, researching into this with the LGBT organisations and the trans organisations that are on the front line of this. Because we even found out, preparing for this episode, like, if you search one thing, the amount of either far-right news articles or misinformed blogs or so-called, you know, LGB organizations or whatever. It's just filled with misinformation. So go to the LGBT organizations and trans organizations that are doing this work, like Mermaids, like Gender GP, like Gendered Intelligence. They're breaking all of this down and actually showing what it means and why it's not as scary as it possibly sounds when, you know, it's being championed by trans exclusionary people.
So without further ado, here is Marianne.
So I'm Marianne Oakes. I am a therapeutic counsellor, and my pronouns are she, her.
Can you give us a bit of background about the work that you do, please?
So basically, I'm a therapeutic counsellor, which basically means that I offer therapy to anybody, really, who wants therapy. I'm also a hypnotherapist as well. But my work's obviously taken me in a direction where I work almost exclusively with transgender clients, people at all different stages of transition, from the, you know, somebody that's just thinking they may be trans to people who are trans and want to know and help support going through transition. And that does lead me. So I have a private practice where I work, where people come direct to me. But I also, my main work, my body of work is through Gender GP, because obviously working in this area, I made a connection with the founder, Dr. Helen Weberly, and she just asked me, would I go and do work for them? So my title there is lead therapist. So I make sure the training that all the therapists that deliver therapy to trans clients, because we don't have all trans therapists, sadly, that they're delivering consistent therapeutic care. And that it follows with the ethos, not just of Gender GP, but myself, who, again, I've worked quite hard with the other people at Gender GP to create an ethos there of how we treat the patient. So that's kind of my main work through them.
This might be a big question to answer, because obviously each client's going to be so unique and have their own journeys themselves. But what does the work kind of look like for people who approach you or Gender GP in terms of therapeutic benefits?
So I think one of the things that we have to understand, you're right, they are all unique, everybody that comes to us. And just to kind of stipulate that our starting point is that everybody's journey is unique to them. So we don't have a criteria that anybody has to fit. But it depends what they come from. From a therapeutic side of things, is the first thing I say to everybody that comes to see me, I'll work hard to be what you need me to be. And that means that I will be out and out counsellor, you know, challenging them on the thought processes, trying to understand why they think like they do, trying to help them to see things from different perspectives. But I'll also be kind of mentor. You know, some people come and they'll say like, oh, I want to come out at work, or I want to come out to my parents or my partner or whoever. And we'll talk about the language and actually, you know, what will that mean? What do you want to come out? What do you actually want to tell them? You know, do you want to unburden themselves? But actually, what do you actually want to say? What do you want to get from that interaction? So helping people to put a language and understand what it is that they're trying to say. And other people, you know, I'll get somebody who'll come and say, I think I might be trans. You know, that's the starting point. And, you know, my question back to everybody is, what makes you think that? And they'll start, and then you'll just start unraveling it. The one thing I do say consistently is, if you believe that you are questioning your gender, even to a minimal degree, then to some degree you probably are trans. But let's work out what that means to you in your life going forward.
Wow. I think I did read also you may be, like, talk to parents of trans people who have questions as well.
Yes. So we work with families. That's probably, if I'm honest with you, my main interest is working with trans youth and with the families, because I think they're getting a raw deal from society at the moment. Very misunderstood, but lots of misinformation around there. And I also know some people will listen to this and they'll be screaming, you know, that we shouldn't be working with trans children, but we can't abandon them. Mm-hmm. And what we tend to find is that some of them will come and the parents will book them in for therapy with me. Mm. And honestly, it's the parents that should be coming for the therapy. The kid's there. Yeah, I'm a girl. I'm a boy.
Yeah.
What do you want me to say? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the parents are downstairs biting the nails, you know. Yeah. Oh, my God. I work with families. And I will work in a unique way. I will tailor the needs of the family and depending on who comes. So, for example, this is privately, I have to say. I have a family who I see once every 2 weeks. And we contracted, so all therapy is contracted. We lay out the terms, you know, and what the boundaries are and the confidentiality. And there was the child and the two parents wanted to be involved. And in the background running about, because it's online, it was the younger sibling. So we contracted that actually there are no secrets, that whoever wants to come to each therapy session, you know, whose needs are greatest, they can do. But you don't say anything to me that we wouldn't talk about as a group. And so they just, you know, I don't know who's going to turn up when I see them. Mainly it's all of them. But the dad's been having an issue. The dad can tend to be, he's on board and he really, really wants to be supportive, but he's got his issues. So we spend a lot of time coming up with ways for them to interact better as a family and to have empathy for each other. You know, just because somebody's got a problem with this, we don't demonize them. We don't, you know, they're not transphobic just because they've got, how can I say, rigid thought processes about how life is. We've got to have empathy for that and work with them. So, and that's not out and out, you know, family therapy. It's working with the family, sharing experiences, creating a space where they can be honest. And I facilitate it so, you know, that stop it turning into just a big argument. And then they go away for the week and process. So, yeah, family therapy, really important.
Yeah. I mean, even in that example, the fact that person is still turning up every week, even if they've got issues, that in itself is an enormous thing, because if actually, like, there's obviously something in there where he wants to, you know, understand more and be better at what he does. So that's, I guess, that's a positive, isn't it? Even these things can take time as well. So I guess it's a silver lining, isn't it?
The biggest issue I think with parents is that this is something they're just not prepared for. You know, you can see, sometimes you'll see an effeminate boy and think, oh, they're going to go up and be gay. Or you'll see, you know, a tomboy or, you know, masculine girl and you'll think, oh, they're going to be a lesbian.
Yeah.
And even now, even in 2022, with all the stuff that's going around, rarely do they think, oh, they could be trans. And when they say that word, the T word, you know, the whole world falls apart. And that's why I believe, firmly believe, and if there are any parents listening to this podcast, you know, it's okay, but you need to process it. You need to come and talk to somebody as well. And you can't fake support. I think it's the same for all LGBTQ plus people. You know, they'll come out to the parents and the parents will be, oh, yeah, we'll love you, whatever, you know, but then there's this distance starts growing. And I think it's sad. I think it's sad when it could be helped. I'm obviously pro therapy, but
yeah. But I mean, any kind of education around, we spoke about it in our upbringing episode we did a few seasons ago, and any kind of education that kind of just so you learn a bit more about what it is to be LGBTQ plus is going to be beneficial to whoever you're interacting with if you are a parent. But one of the things I really loved that's on Gender GP's website, which is your blog, which you kind of tracked your transition and going through the NHS and things like that, including wait times, which just sounded like a huge ordeal. How has your own experience informed the work you do?
Interestingly enough, I used myself as an experiment. So I came across Gender GP probably halfway through the wait, and part of me thought, do I just go with gender GP? You know, I'm embedded there. And I thought, but how can I have an empathy, a genuine empathy for the people that are on that wait that can't afford gender GP or, you know, are frightened of going privately? So I decided to stick it out as it happens. I do have to say I was really fortunate. I've got a supportive family. I was fully socially transitioned. I was working as a female therapist. I think for the people who are on that wait and it's their lifeline to a new life, I think it's a totally different experience. And that's where desperation creeps in. But yeah, that I did it purely so I could have an empathy for those going through it, and also share the experience of what to expect when you get there. Not that all the clinicians are the same, but I think the broad package of care across all the GICs is very similar. So yeah, a bit of a guinea pig.
And I mean, one of the wait times, obviously we've mentioned there, but I think it was only last week or the week before, they've got even longer than they were a year ago. I think it's something ridiculous, isn't like 7 to 12 years if someone signs onto the register now, I think is what it said last week, which when people are getting annoyed at other wait times for like other sorts of treatments and it's 6 or 12 months, you just think like when you explain the what trans people are facing, people just can't wrap their head around it. It seems so ludicrous. But as well as that, what are some of the other, for people that are listening, we've covered different things around this before. We've kind of touched on different areas of it, but from your experience, what are some of the main challenges that trans people face when it comes to accessing healthcare? And I guess the secondary question is, do you think the media coverage around it, and as you mentioned before, the society's framing of being trans right now, do you think that's also having an impact on it?
I think it's all, I think the trouble that we're having is that we get something in the headlines. It was the GRA that kicked everything off, I believe. And that goes back to 2014, 2015, when the Women's and Equality Committee did this thing and said that transgender healthcare needs overhauling. It is, you know, it is failing the service users. I think in terms of the trouble that we've got is that there's, am I allowed to say anything controversial?
Please.
Yeah.
So this is opinion. The transgender healthcare in the UK, there is a tiny few people at the top that have got a tight grip on it, using expert status, professors, you know, that believe they're an expert. Now, the one thing you'll never hear me say about myself is that I'm an expert in this. I believe that the patients are their expert in their own life, that there's no expert. The care that they're wanting to access to get on with their lives is very, very simple and could happen in primary care. But when they try to access primary care and the GP looks at what's happened to other GPs when they've tried to help trans patients, they don't want to go near it. And the reality is that they then refer them on to the GICs, and the GICs, because they're trying to keep such a tight grip, you know, it's like a boys' club. You know, they won't let people in easily. They can't expand the staff quick enough. It's a very boring area of healthcare. If I'd got if I was a doctor and I'd done 7 years training, you don't want to be dishing out hormones for your career. You know, you're going to have more aspirations than that. So getting people to work in that, but they keep that tight grip on it, that the model of care won't change. They won't ease it so that there's easier flow, so that we can and just send people back to the GPs and say, you know, you can prescribe this.
Yeah.
They could have a network of people like myself. There's lots of therapists out there who they could have a network that if GPs, they could offer contracts out to, so it could be dealt with more cheaply than having their own in-house GPs. So what we did get then is this compounding, this wait list is going up. The people at the top don't want to let go. And all I get when I talk to anybody about it is, what I've got to understand is things won't change that quickly. If this was any other area of healthcare and there were advances and global, you know, things happening globally to advance the healthcare, it would happen within 2 or 3 years.
Mm.
This has been going on since 2014 and nothing's changed. It's just got worse.
Yeah.
So, and then the headlines start coming and then people think, oh, these trans people demanding healthcare, you know, who yeah. are we? Why should the taxpayer pay for you? Well, why should we pay for anybody?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Where do we draw the line? So, yeah, I don't know if that's answered the question, but I've ranted a bit there.
Yeah, no. And I think, to be honest, I think with that sort of a question, that's typically going to be the answer because it is such a shit show in this country, isn't it, at the minute?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One of the things I was going to... So for anyone that isn't too sure, GIC is a gender identity clinic.
Yes.
And how many are there in the UK at the minute? Do you know that number?
So I do have to say, there has been a change in the last 2 years. So there were 7, I think there was. Mm. And they all tend to be, apart from Exeter, dotted up the M1. So, you know, if you live, you know, nowhere near the M1 or Exeter, it's a hell of a... And with the infrastructure. So it's not exactly accessible.
Mm.
But the truth of the matter is they've started doing these pilot schemes now. So there's one in London, Liverpool, Manchester, Cardiff, I can't think. There's a few pilot schemes where they have brought it, so they've speeded it up. They are getting people onto the hormones quicker.
Mm.
However, it's still relatively small numbers.
Mm.
And there's no guarantee that they're going to roll out the scheme.
Yeah.
Generally, in Sussex in particular, I think that's where Brighton is. I think it's Sussex. They've got a training program. I've got a friend who works for the Clare Project down there. They go around training GPs up how to offer care, and they're trying to get GP practices to sign up. So anybody in Sussex eventually will be able to go to the GP practice and get access to hormones.
Mm.
That's what we need. Whether they'll stick with it, you know, it's all just a pilot scheme. We don't know yet. And again, this scene's still such, considering the volume of numbers because of the wait list, it's still very relatively small numbers. But at least they're trying.
Yeah, it's just mad, isn't it? When you think of some of the headlines, like ones about, you know, transitioning children and they just go to the GP once and all of a sudden that's it. And like, the reality is not that, is it? And we spoke to Charlie Craigs a little while ago on her show on BBC iPlayer, Transitioning Teens. She in there discusses essentially both sides of, you know, quote unquote, the debate around trans healthcare and trans people in general. All we need is, not all we need, that's a very, very small statement, but what we need is just more people that know what they're doing and are able to help, because that will, just more support, more funding, more places to get help and support, because at the minute, it's, as you say, it's just gatekept, isn't it?
So for the children, it's a different model of care altogether. So... how can I say with the children, this idea that you just go to the GIC and they put you on blockers straight away. They will not put you on blockers until you're 16 now.
Mm.
And that goes back well before the Bell case.
Mm.
They were on, it's too late. There's no good putting puberty blockers in place then. Mm-hmm. You might as well move them straight onto the hormones.
Mm.
But there are lots of people coming out with fancy titles of professor this, psychiatrist and all of that. And I'm not doubting the qualifications, but they've not worked with this patient group. They've certainly not worked with this patient group to the degree that somebody like I have. Mm. And be under no illusion, this idea that we're grooming kids to be trans, the last thing I would want is for a cis person of any age to go through this process.
Mm.
For a cis man, for example, to have estrogen and start developing the secondary sex characteristics of a female would be abhorrent.
Mm.
I know, because I was in the other direction and it is abhorrent. And if you can't understand that, then there's nothing, no opinion you're gonna have that holds any water. You've got to understand what the patient's going through. So you can have psychiatrists, you can have whistleblowers. From what I can gather, most of the whistleblowers from GIDS, which is the gender identity, GIDS? Gender Identity Development Services.
Mm-hmm.
They deal or with trans youth. Mm. We'll get whistleblowers from there, but when you look at it, they've hardly worked. They've not got to know the patients.
Mm-hmm.
And what they see is somebody at 16 being put on puberty blockers, and they're going, oh, my God, this is, you know, horrendous.
Yeah.
They don't know what the child's been going through. They don't know what state they were in before they went there.
Yeah, the history.
And I think it's easy to start saying whistleblowers, and just because somebody walked past the door of the Tavistock one day doesn't make them an expert.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, I mean, because honestly, who would want to? And it's just homophobia rehashed, isn't it? Like decades old homophobia that's mm-hmm. rehashed. Who, like in their right mind, would choose that path, knowing what they're going to then have to deal with? It doesn't make sense. Yeah.
You mentioned the pilot schemes popping up around the UK, but for the people that are currently on like a waiting list for the NHS, do you have any tips for sticking in there and having a bit more hope for what's to come?
I think it is moving in the right direction. I think the thing that's causing most... So we've got, I don't know what the word is, but we've got like a... we've got this social change happening. I always say... Mm-hmm. In the work that I do, I'm working at the vanguard of social change, which is fantastic to be there. But we're going through the most horrendous vilification in the press. Even Boris Johnson, Rishi Sunak, they're all coming out with unqualified statements. You know, if we start talking about trans women in sports, which we could have a whole podcast on.
Yeah.
But the truth about it, all that's coming out, and all that's doing is feeding into the shame and the stigma. Mm. Of these people that are on the waiting list. So if that wasn't there, if we could mute all that noise around this and we could work with people, you know, there's no reason why they can't transition without accessing the care. Given the right support, certainly with therapy, doing it carefully, finding the right spaces to get used to it, to feel comfortable.
Mm.
There are things you could do, but what all this noise is forcing everybody to stay closeted, going back to the 80s and 90s with the LGBT community back then and the vilification over AIDS and all of that. It was all designed to keep you in the closet.
Yeah.
And what they're trying to, and it's working. And then they're putting you on a 7-year wait list. And your mental health starts to go. And then we come, and everybody wonders why we're so sensitive and defensive of our, identities. I don't know about you guys, but when I shouldn't be embarrassed because I feel like I'm stigmatizing this now, but the word was transvestite. Mm. That was the first word that described anything close to what I was experiencing. Mm. And I held on to that like life itself.
Yeah.
It was like the first time in my life I realized there was a word for it and there must be other people.
Mm-hmm.
So when we find our identity, it is really important to us. And then to have all this, rubbish thrown at us that bears no resemblance to our experience, it just keeps people closeted, and it's not healthy, and it's not. I don't think it makes any. No, there's no winners in it really, because we're still there. We're just putting more pressure on the NHS with mental health services then.
Mm. I know we've only got a couple of minutes, but one of the things I wanted to raise, and I think this came out today or yesterday, there was a new report, I think it was a US report, that shows that 94% of trans kids maintain their trans identity after 5 years, while another 3.5% identified as non-binary. It's part of a huge piece of research that essentially just debunks this idea that is being pushed that, you know, the amount of detransitioners is enormous. More research like that obviously is needed, isn't it? Because having that sort of data just proves all of that shit wrong. Have you seen that research, and kind of what are your just initial thoughts on that sort of thing?
I've only read an article on the research, but they're not telling me anything we didn't already know. It's nice to have it there, and it's good that there are people in the background doing that. The challenge is, really, do you know if somebody came out as gay?
Mm.
And you don't want somebody following you around with a clipboard asking you how happy you are and how long are you going to be gay for. And oh, it's been 5 years now, so you're probably gay. You know, why should trans people have that? It's just, but yeah. I just understand that we need it, and I'm glad there are people doing it, and I just hope they're doing it in a sensitive way. Can I just make one quick point, though?
Of course,
And I think this is might be deemed controversial. I've had an interaction with a transphobe over the past few days. My hometown, they posted, like, they'd had this meal with J.K. Rowling masks on.
Yeah.
And there was a name on, so I researched them, and I found them on Facebook, and I've had this interaction with them. And at no point have I ever called them a transphobe. At no point have I insulted them. I mean, I'm calling them a transphobe now, but that's how they came into my awareness. And we've had this interaction. It's been tough. And they've been quoting all this stuff from Transgender Trend, basically, at me.
Yeah.
And I've been going back and countering it. It's been tense at times. It's all on messaging. And yesterday they kind of came on and they just said, you've got to stop this using your professional qualifications as a justification that what I believe is wrong. And I took a breath and I went back and I just went and said, look, I am a qualified mental health professional. I can't help that. I do work in this area and I do know about it. What I don't know is how it feels to be the parent of a trans child. I said, and that was, you know, and I can't imagine what you go through. I don't know she's a parent. I'm guessing she's a parent now. But just because of the stuff she said and how determined she was to convince me she knew. And I said, it must be horrible. And, you know, you've got your own, you know, I didn't say it to her. I kind of said it, that they must have their own processes to go through. And when you go out there and you're looking for information, you're going to find the stuff that confirms your own bias because that's, and you want hope that my child might not be trans. And I said, but I'm here to help if you want.
Yeah.
And what I thought was that, you know, if we could get interactions that were more respectful, that wasn't about beating each other around the head with words and insults, that we could start and have a decent dialogue. I don't believe in debate. I think decent dialogue is the way forward. And it's kind of taught me a lesson, and I'm going to start and just step back now. Name calling isn't getting anybody anywhere. It's just damaging everybody. I'm sure there's some trans people out there going to be shouting at me.
No, I think that was a really nice way to finish it.
Absolutely.
Because, yeah, people, it's such a horrible, toxic environment online. And yeah, I think just sometimes just taking a bit of a step back is the way to do it, isn't it?
Yeah, and understanding what somebody else is going through. And that behind every behaviour, there's an emotion. It's as simple as that. And that goes for all the, you know, the JKs and other celebrities that are trying to get involved in this. So much going on for them, and we've got to understand that. But it shouldn't block us all moving forward as a society.
Thank you again, Marianne, for your time.
Thank you so much.
So for now, that's all we've got for you. As always, we'll put our links, any relevant articles, anything that was discussed in the interview, and then also contact details should you wish to find out more from Marianne. We'll put those in the show notes and on the website. So bottomingpodcast.com. You can also follow us on Instagram, Twitter, The Law, at Bottoming Pod.
Great.
As mentioned at the start of this episode, join us immediately after on our second of the two. We've got a little announcement for you.
Wouldn't you like to know what we've got to say? Wouldn't you like to know?
I can't wait to see how this turns out.
Okay, toodaloo.
Okay, bye.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.